Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So I'm winding up the last few stories, and there's just a couple from the last week's top 10 stories of scientific advances in 2025. And one of the top 10 stories from 2024 was, of course, all about weight loss drugs and how effective they were being for people with obesity and diabetes. We'd known about diabetes for a while, but the obesity kind of took us by storm. And as I remarked recently, it's a good example of when the market system does work. However, these drugs have been showing up in all kinds of studies as having advantages that, well, you wouldn't exactly expect to find. For example, schizophrenia and addiction. Weight loss drugs lower the risk of addiction, schizophrenia, and dementia. Wow, that's pretty interesting when you do the math. They also improve blood flow, and that includes blood flow to the brain. They reduce inflammation there. That may account for some of the effects. Unfortunately, these preliminary reports don't always pan out. Novo Nordisk just recently said that its studies on semaglutide, the active ingredient in Ozempic and Wegovy, had no effect on cognition and functioning among people with dementia or mild cognitive impairment. Just parenthetically, it's really hard to test mild cognitive impairment. A lot of that's based on attention and how much sleep the person got the night before. And ultimately, there's a lot of variability, and variability is the enemy of statistical significance. So it's tough to do. Our last thing of the year, if you will, that was pretty remarkable, is the first successful human bladder transplants. On May 4th, Oscar Larenzar, 41, became the first human to successfully receive a bladder transplant. There are a lot of cases of bladder cancer in the United States. 84,000 new cases per year. And a lot of times people with bladder cancer also end up with cancer of the kidney as well. This particular person had a kidney and bladder transplant. It's easier to transplant both than it is to transplant just the bladder. That's been part of the problem. The bladder has a complex network of blood vessels, very difficult, and nerves, very difficult to hook that stuff back up again and get it to work right. But in the case of Larenzar, he did well immediately, and the technique very carefully reattached the blood vessels in the bladder, and they managed to learn how to do it. It took multiple surgeries on cadavers that had that were on active heart, basically pacemakers and ventilators and pumps, so that they could really mimic a living bloodstream and all of the circulatory system, so that the doctors could see if they got it right, and that the organ, as soon as it was transplanted, pinked right up. Well, they finally got it right, and now this opens up great pathways for possibly being able to replace bladders. I don't know if they'll always have to replace it with a kidney. Hopefully what they learned from this surgery is step one towards only just doing bladder transplants. My dear stepfather did develop bladder cancer late in his life, and had to have his bladder removed after the conservative management failed. He was offered the option of having a portion of his small intestine removed and turned into a quote-unquote pseudo-bladder, or simply having the equivalent of a colostomy, except it was a ureterostomy, to bring urine to the surface of his body. And he actually opted for that, largely because he didn't want the pain and the surgical scars and all of the complexity that went along with the neo bladder, as they were then calling them. And being a practical old, you know, World War II generation guy, he just made do and adjusted quite well. Actually, he sort of preferred it because he'd had a bad prostate, and for the first time in 20 years, he could sleep through the night. It's interesting. You can't always know how people are going to adapt to body changes. Well, we had quite a few emails in the last week, so we're going to weeks, I should say, plural. So we're going to get through some of these. The first one I want to go back to last week was from Liz in Durham, North Carolina. And she had wanted to know about things she could do to get her omega-3 levels up. And we answered that question. But she also, her real goal was cognitive health. And she wanted to know about purslane. And she said, a friend sent these two studies, which included purslane in their interventions. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I went and looked at the articles because I hadn't ever heard about purslane, which is one of the many leafy green vegetables that we could be eating, but usually aren't. This one is actually classified kind of as a weed. The term for that is field greens in the gastronomical vernacular. And there are a lot of people, emerging influencers, if you will, in that area who are going out and foraging their own food and coming up with recipes for it and, you know, doing the influencer thing on various social media places. But anyway, getting back to the purslane, the letter that Liz sent made it sound like that she had been told by a friend that purslane actually specifically was good for cognition. And the two articles, it was kind of ironic, said nothing whatsoever about purslane being good for cognition. One of them was a reference to the Lyon Heart Study, L-Y-O-N, Heart Study, which was one of the things that came out back in the early days of talking about Mediterranean diets. This was the diet that they eat in Lyon, France. And that diet is Mediterranean-ish, lots of a certain amount of grains, lots of green vegetables, but also a bit more meat than the standard Mediterranean diet. Anyway, yeah, so they cook up pot greens and they use purslane in soups and they use it in mixed, you know, fried green type dishes. But there's nothing special in that article that's cognition. And the other article was extolled purslane's antioxidant properties and talked about its, you know, that it was an antioxidant. But it really didn't say anything whatsoever about memory. That was that was basically an extrapolation from whatever website used these two things as references that your friend, Liz's friend, told her about. And I see that a lot. I see these references and I thought, oh, good, we're going to have some science to back up this statement about something that sounds, you know, really fantastic if it's true. And then you go and look at the reference and the reference is genuinely a reference. But even the abstract doesn't say anything. So beware when you go online and you see one of these websites who says scientifically proven. And then maybe there's even a little star or a footnote numeral, and then you go down and there's a couple of articles. If you actually go and look at the articles, they often have nothing to do with the claims on the website. It's just, I should call that protective coloration. Okay, our next email comes from Antonio in Fort Myers, Florida. Antonio writes, I'm 70 years old, relatively healthy, 5'6", and weigh about 150 pounds. I've been taking statins for about 4 years now after labs demonstrated my total cholesterol of 220 with LDL of 146, HDL of 41, and triglycerides of 189. My other labs remain within normal limits. I was initially given 4 years ago generic atorvastatin, 10 milligrams a day, but after 2 years, I started developing musculoskeletal discomforts, mostly bilateral gastroc, muscle aching. One time, however, I developed bilateral knee pain so severe I was almost unable to walk. I stopped the atorvastatin and these issues went away. Subsequently, I was given rosuvastatin 10 milligrams and got my blood work back in control. Now, after 2 years on generic rosuvastatin, I'm developing muscle discomfort, mainly affecting my both legs. I have mild, basically he has the same symptoms he had before. But now he has severe pain and discomfort in his hamstrings. And he says it's sometimes like being stabbed. It's so severe that getting out of bed as well as sitting and standing are a challenge. For 4 weeks, I've been taking 200 milligrams of ibuprofen in the mornings. And later by evenings, I get the discomfort back. The next day, same thing. If I don't take the pain medication, I wouldn't be able to do my activities at all. Interestingly, I'm able to bike with no distress. I stopped that generic rosuvastatin about 2 weeks ago, but this time the pain has persisted. Again, getting better after the ibuprofen. He lists his other medications, and he takes CoQ10 200 milligrams, as well as a number of other supplements. I'm not going to go through all of it. He finishes. I've read about statin alternatives to control cholesterol and triglycerides, estimibi and bempedoic acid. I've read that taking bempedoic acid comes with the risk of getting tendon problems if you're over 60. I'm 70 and have had tendon problems. What do you suggest? Well, Antonio, it's first of all, I don't think you should be on statins. You've been on two and you developed a classic symptom from statins. So I'm going to suggest that we find another way to control your not all that bad cholesterol. And I have one right out of the box. You said your triglycerides were 189. That indicates insulin resistance. If I had been your physician, I'm going to second guess a physician now and say, I might have given you a statin, but I would have also given you metformin, probably about 2,500 milligrams a day in divided doses to try to get your insulin levels down. And that would have sent your protective high-density cholesterol up, which would have rebalanced things. I would probably also have gotten a panel looking at your lipid, at the size of your particles, and looking at your inflammation, because those are big factors. Your kidney function, your smoking, your blood pressure, these are also things that I would have really worked on to try to meaningfully reduce your coronary artery disease risk, because cholesterol is not a disease. Heart disease is a disease. Cholesterol is a risk factor for disease. And you know what your big risk factor is? It's actually your age. So I'm so glad you exercise regularly. And getting on top of this is important. The Estimibe, I think, is the best way to lower your cholesterol safely, along with oat bran. And I would be trying to get that LDL as low as I could and then measure the particle size of your LDL. Because if you have big particles, they're not nearly as dangerous. So low inflammation, low insulin, low blood sugar. And if I had to, and I think you have a problem with CoQ10, so I'd probably give you a compounded infusion of CoQ10, and you can look locally there in Florida for someone who is a certified functional medicine practitioner. Just go to functionalmedicine.org and find someone who will work with you, because this situation could get a lot better very quickly. All right, we're going to go to that first caller and see if you've patiently held out. Are you still there? You're on the air.
I am.
Okay.
I am.
Hi. So what can I do for you?
Well, I have a question or a different thought on cholesterol.
Go for it.
Cholesterol, what I've heard, is a basic building block for vitamin D, correct?
Yes. Vitamin D is built from the cholesterol molecule. That's true.
Okay. Now, My theory is, well, let's go to, let's say, a hand with no calluses on it. And you go to start working out, and the bars and they're old, and it starts to form blisters. Then the blisters go to plaque, in essence. And so my theory is that cholesterol isn't that big a deal when you look at how toxic the things that we're taking in are creating problems or toxic environments in our blood. And the body is just trying to wall off the toxicity by putting the plaquing there in the arteries. What do you think?
Well, actually, it's very interesting that you came up with your hypothesis, because actually there's a guy, you may have heard of him. He won 2 Nobel Prizes, one for peace. His name was Linus Pauling. And his idea about cholesterol and plaque was that plaque was equivalent to a callus or a scab. He observed that plaque usually occurs at curves or bifurcations. In other words, a fork in the road. And if you imagine blood moving down a tube, when it hits that fork in the road, it's going to splash. And it interferes with the normal laminar smooth flow of the blood. And so his idea was that plaque formed to protect the vascular wall at that point because it was getting damaged. And that if you gave large amounts of, he was very big on vitamin C, if you gave large amounts of vitamin C, that might protect against plaque formation. And of course, he also was very big on using, we're talking 18 grams a day, massive amounts of vitamin C for the treatment of common colds. And intravenous vitamin C at doses of like 250 grams, massive doses of vitamin C, as part of cancer treatment. And I'm not going to go any deeper into Linus Pauling, but he was a genius, and a lot of his ideas actually are valid. Now, let's take a look at cholesterol. You mentioned vitamin D, which is not a vitamin, it's a hormone. And it's a steroid hormone. It's manufactured by the body, like testosterone, like estrogen, like cortisol, like aldosterone. They all have similar erone names because they are all based on the same root molecule, and they are absolutely critical for life. I worry about the cardiologists who are, you know, they're one trick ponies. They're gonna save the heart. That's their mission, and they are missionaries. But the problem is, if you get that total cholesterol below about 130, you start messing with the cortisol, the body clock, the brain hormones, the kidney function. I mean, there isn't enough signaling molecule to go around to do the basic signaling stuff, and the benefit in terms of reducing heart rate is heart attack rate is really diminishing returns. It's cholesterol has been overwhelmingly overhyped as the target because we have a drug, and if we have a drug, we're going to hype that target and convince everyone that they need it, or convince everyone that if they don't prescribe it, they'll be sued by the grieving relatives of the person who had the heart attack. But realistically, if you treat someone to lower their cholesterol using a statin, and they are all the same age and they're all male and they all don't smoke and they don't have high blood pressure, in order to prevent one heart attack, you actually have to treat 50 people for 10 years statistically to prevent that one heart attack. So the benefit in people who don't have the disease is not that great. But some people have biological factors that lead them to develop these plaques, and the plaques themselves are unstable because of inflammation. Inflammation is probably a more important reason that statins work at all, not because they lower cholesterol, which they do, but because they are pretty good anti-inflammatories, like omega-3 fatty acids. And that this anti-inflammatory effect halts the rapid progression of those calluses into, you know, basically storage balloons for fat. And, you know, if that balloon pops and that fat is exposed to the platelets in the bloodstream, that's what sets a heart attack off in motion. So stabilizing plaques by reducing inflammation, which reduces the deposition of cholesterol into the plaques. It's all one very big, complicated ecosystem, if you will, that's going on in there. But so you are right, but it's a yes and kind of right.
Okay. The reason I think about statins in that way is my mother entered the hospital in her late 70s, and they gave her statins for high cholesterol. What other reason, I don't know. And they determined that this is really bad for her, and they put a red flag in her chart that mm-hmm. said, do not give this person statins. And she entered the hospital again in her 80s, and they were going to dispense statins to her until they found the red note, a red light in the file. And that's just, it's scary to think about the effects that can have, but they're given out so freely.
Exactly. And that side effect your mother had was almost certainly rhabdomyolysis, which is basically the statins melt your muscles. And the and the muscles release myoglobin, which is the muscle equivalent of hemoglobin. It's there to hold oxygen because moving muscles is, firing off muscles uses a lot of oxygen. So when the myoglobin, when the cell dies, it leaks and the myoglobin has to be gotten rid of, and it blocks the kidneys. So it clogs up the kidneys and puts people into renal failure. And so probably because she was in the hospital, they noticed that her pee turned red, and they immediately checked for blood and found positive. They found myoglobin in her urine, and immediately it's like, okay, statin plus myoglobin in the urine, this person can never take this drug ever.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad that information got transferred through the multiple computer through the multiple changes in computer platform and whatever else goes on. I mean, that's one of the big Achilles heels of our system, and I'm always ranting about it, is that the data transfer between hospitals and into the new hospital system was basically systematically sabotaged by big business, who wanted to lock people into their particular system, whether it was Cerner or Epic. They wanted to make it as hard as possible for companies to change their vendor and go to a new, better medical record. And they wanted to make it as difficult as possible to transfer the patient data. And in doing so, they've killed God knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people because of medical errors, such as the one that your mother narrowly avoided, which could, I mean, it's uncountable. It's impossible to even put a number on it. I'll just say, in my opinion, it sure isn't zero.
They finally did kill her. She went, it was a Labor Day, and she got a little, she couldn't form her words and very easily, and she looked a little disoriented. And they took her into the hospital. They did an MRI. They saw something in her brain, and they said, oh, well, you've got brain cancer. You're going to put on radiation therapy. And so, you know, she, conforming to what they said, she went in. After two treatments of radiation, she could no longer walk out of the hospital. She had to be carried out of the hospital. In 8 weeks after that diagnosis, she died. And after that, I looked at the death certificate, and it said cause of death. It didn't say brain cancer. It said stomach cancer. And then they crossed that out and put pancreatic cancer as the cause of death. So, I mean, we have to come up with some better standards to understand how the body works.
Wow, that's quite a story. They never let me cross anything out. I have to fill the form out all over again.
Yeah, this was in Oregon. So I don't know if the laws are different there. But there's my thought on blocking and statins.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our next email comes from Annie in Aptos. Annie writes, ask Dr. Don recurrent UTI. Hi, Dr. Don. What is your advice for recurrent UTI? I had 4 in less than 2 months. I'm at 79, active with good health. Urologist suggested vaginal cream, cranberry tablets, D-mannose, and 64 ounces of water a day. Thank you, over 30-year appreciative listener. Well, congratulations, Annie, for being able to continue to find me over 30 years, hopping around from call sign to call sign, as we indeed have. So my first question with recurrent UTIs is, how are they being diagnosed? Are we really sure these are UTIs? Because 79-year-old women will get pain and burning with urination and urinary frequency, and sometimes that's just from irritation because the skin is thin and the bladder mucus is kind of dried out and patchy. So the normal protections for the nerves, which of course have a set threshold for when they're going to fire, and said threshold is below the threshold that you feel until your bladder is very stretched. However, if something is interfering, like there's an infection, so there's inflammatory markers, or like I said, there's thinning of the skin or problems with the mucus, then those nerves are going to reach their threshold even, and you know, whether for whatever cause, it all feels the same. So a lot of times if you go to an urgent care, they have you pee into a cup and they dip a strip into the cup and they look for white blood cells and nitrates. And there's plenty of white blood cells and nitrates in your vagina. And so if a little bit of vaginal juice or dried vaginal secretion around the urethra get into that urine, it's going to be false positive for a bladder infection. So in edge cases, I like 1+ white cells, 1+ nitrates. I generally, in my office, will spin the urine and look at it under a microscope because there'll be something called epithelial cells. The vagina is full of those too. And so if you see epithelial cells, you know that that is a contaminated urine. And you wouldn't send that for culture either because it'll grow mixed flora and you might as well not bother. But so I'm going to just say, were those real? I'm going to answer the question as if, yes, those were microscopic. There were lots of white blood cells. There were a few epithelial cells. We saw bacteria. We know that was a bladder infection. That being said, if you got 4 in a couple of months and you're not sexually active, and never assume, then we're going to want to fix your vaginal microbiome, and we're going to want to protect your bladder from bacteria. But those bacteria, they're coming from your vagina, and they're swimming up the urethra, and they're getting into the bladder and managing to put little grappling hooks in there. So the cranberry tablets and the D-mannose that your doctor suggested, it are actually a good idea. D-mannose is a sugar molecule. You take about 500 milligrams twice a day. It gets the it makes the inside of the bladder slippery and slicky, and it's hard for the bacteria to stick. Cranberry juice does something as well, or cranberry tablets. The combination is like a 1-2 punch for making it hard for the bacteria to get established. The next thing I would think of would be to check a post-void residual. This is a simple bladder ultrasound, and effectively, you go into the ultrasound suite. They look at your bladder volume, and they see whether, when you feel full, are you really full? Do you have, you know, 800 cc's of urine in there, or do you have 150, and you still feel like you need to pee? If the second is the case, then you have a sensitive bladder, and you have a, and we're going to need to work on that in different ways. If, in fact, you get up to 800, then you empty. What do you empty down to? And if there's still 200 cc's of fluid left in your bladder when you feel empty, then you have a high residual volume, and that's going to sit up there and provide a place for bacteria to live. We want to clear the urine, wash all the bacteria out, but you aren't. You've basically got a little reservoir, like a seed bank of bacteria sitting around in your bladder at all times. So that's not good. The other advice they gave you, 64 ounces of water a day. That's, you know, that's 2 liters. That's a decent amount of water unless you have congestive heart failure, or other issues. My desire is that you should empty your bladder once in the middle of the night and go back to sleep. You don't have, so whatever amount of your, of water taken throughout the day, if you're emptying every 4 hours, you're going to be fine. You want to change your vaginal microbiome, and for that, you're going to want to use probiotics that are largely lactobacillus, that you can purchase specialized female or women's probiotics that usually code for this. You can either insert them in the vagina or you can take them orally. They will find their way into your vagina. I also will often give vaginal DHEA. It's available as a pharmaceutical called Intra Rosa or Prosterone, but you can also have it formulated by compounding pharmacists, and it really doesn't matter how you get it in there. DHEA will cause the lining of the bladder and the lining of the urethra to thicken back more to the level it was when you were menstruating, and that's going to make a big difference in terms of both the innate health and disease resistant, and also any irritability features that you might be experiencing. For example, if you weren't able to hold more than, say, 300 cc's in your bladder during that test, the ultrasound, that would tell us that you had irritability and you'd want to be using some of that DHEA to address that. So, as you can see, this is a multifactorial issue. There can be a lot of different things going on. And the first thing we have to do is question the basic premise that these were, in fact, all urinary tract infections. There's a whole nother dissertation I could give on interstitial cystitis, which is basically where the bladder mucus is inadequate and food sensitivities develop and people have extreme reactivity in their bladder to a lot of the stuff that normally gets put in the urine by the kidneys and has a perfect right to be there, but is acting as irritant because the mucus is inadequate to protect. So we'll stop there. But if you've ever had dry eyes, you can imagine how that little thin, almost invisible moisture layer in your eyes is actually protecting you from infection, protecting you from trauma, and making you a heck of a lot more comfortable. Well, since we're on the theme for medical breakthroughs, I thought I would talk about this thing that they just did at Stanford this last year. And this was a phase 3 clinical trial. So this is like, you know, ready for production, just show that it's safe. And these were treating people who have a rare genetic disease called dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa. It's a genetic condition in which the skin is so fragile that the lightest touch can lead to blistering and wounds, and eventually those wounds evolve into large open lesions that never heal, but the nerves are right there, and they're plenty painful. Severe dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa is rare, only about one in every 500,000 people. What is it? Well, it's a defect in the gene for collagen 7. Collagen 7 is a protein that holds the skin together, rather like the staple that attaches the top layer of your skin to the bottom layer of your skin. And without this molecular staple, the layers of the patient's skin separate in response to slight friction, even a light touch. This causes wounds that can persist for years, as well as extreme pain and itching. These kids are wrapped around in wound dressings almost from head to toe just to protect their delicate skin, said Dr. Tang. They're known as butterfly children because their skin is as fragile as butterfly wings. Now, this fragility is different than what we see in older people's forearm skin. Our forearms are exposed to sun as probably more than any other part of our body. And the skin is not that thick in the first place. So you'll often see situations where a person, let's say someone who's 75 or 80 years old, just brushes by a blunt surface like the edge of a table and their skin peels back. Now, this is their epidermis. It's a much more superficial layer than the dermal layer that these children are experiencing. They're getting down to the blood vessel, below the blood vessel layer, and so they're really, really affecting the nerves. And the wounds are, of course, prone to infection, and even bathing is painful. These children, because they're constantly healing, are at very high risk for skin cancer. And other parts of the body are also affected, like layers of the digestive tract. Skin grafts have been part of the therapy to improve EB, but another treatment, there's a gene therapy gel that can be applied to the skin. That's been available since 2023, and it does help prevent and heal smaller wounds, but patients still need an effective way to treat the bigger, more persistent wounds. And skin grafts fit the bill, and it's taken 2 years at Stanford for them to come up with this amazing, amazing new therapy. Starting in about 2003, Paul Cavare developed a safe and effective way to genetically engineer the skin cells coming from these individuals with a corrected gene. And they were able to show that it could, that the skin would grow functioning collagen 7 and do the stapling. And it took 2 decades to develop a skin therapy graft for people. So the way they make these, each patient has to have their skin grafts grown individually. So it starts with a small biopsy of the patient's unwounded skin. There, a retrovirus is used to introduce a corrected version of the collagen 7 gene in the lab. And these genetically engineered cells are grown into sheets of skin, each about the size of a credit card. It takes about 25 days to make one. And of course, they'll make multiples in parallel in order to have enough to cover up these wounds. And then they simply just suture it on. And because it's made from the patient's own skin, there's no tissue rejection. So the recent successful phase 3 study on this used 11 patients. They all had the recessive EB gene. And they compared wounds from similar locations on one person. So one wound from each pair got the genetically engineered skin graft, and the other got usual care, which would be bandaging plus the gels. And they, since each patient had multiple areas of unhealing wounds, they included about 23 wound pairs. At 24 weeks after grafting, 81% of the treated wounds were at least half healed, compared with 16 of the control wounds. At 48 weeks, 65% were fully healed, compared with 7% of control wounds. And the patient's symptoms were much better. So the adverse results were very minimal. Obviously, this is preliminary, but the fact that we can grow skin grafts that will have the corrected protein embedded in them so that it's a reasonable expectation that this will persist and that these wounds will be, if not completely healed, at least drastically shrunken and can undergo complete healing after another cycle. A very rare disease, but the techniques and the strategies that are being developed here have implications across medicine for everyone. Really astonishing work. Well, here's a nice feel-good one. Premature babies heard recordings of their mothers reading to them had more mature white matter in a key language area of their brain. A study that was run also at Stanford, as it happens, then was published online this year in October 13th in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. So these were hospitalized extreme preemies, and they regularly heard recordings of their mothers reading to them. And at the end of the study, MRI brain scans showed that a key language pathway was more mature than that of preemies in the control group. It's the first randomized control style of randomized controlled trial of such an intervention in early childhood development. The researchers knew going into this that parents can't stay in hospital around the clock. An ordinary baby who is able to go home after birth is subjected to so much more auditory stimulation. Even if they're asleep or almost asleep, parts of their brain are not asleep, and they're hearing the sounds and hearing the siblings and hearing the radio and whatever else is going on in their environment. And they all contribute to language development. And premature babies are at extremely high risk for language delays. So the researchers decided to have their mothers read stories to their children and then play the recordings of the mothers speaking 2 hours and 40 minutes a day for a few weeks. And it was a relatively short intervention. And they still saw very major changes in the language tracts. And of course, when you're first born, your brains are just like avid, amazingly hungry to figure out what circuits do I need? What do I need to build in order to understand and to be in this confusing, cacophonous, brightly colored, blurred environment that I'm seeing? I don't know what I'm doing with this information, and there's a whole lot of it. So the brain has the capacity to tune itself to fit the environment. Many of these babies were extremely premature, more than 8 weeks early. And as soon as they got out of the neonatal intensive care unit, they were able to start being part of this study. Imagine what would have happened if we did that while they were still in the ICU. Who knows? They might have better brain circuitry by the time they left the hospitals. The changes that they saw were in the left arcuate fasciculus. This is language processing pathway was more mature in babies in the treatment group. The two hemispheres of the brain process speech differently, the left brain being the less language-oriented. And this, of course, was supported by the findings. The left side grew more than the right side. And it's also amazing that we can see differences in brain development in children. The other things that are coming out of this research is the importance of skin-to-skin contact in babies, especially newborns. They really are designed to thrive with the right environment, and part of that environment in newborns is tactile skin-to-skin contact. Let's spend a little time here talking about recent research, a lot of it published in the last 2 years. I covered one article, I recall, in the last, if not 12, at least 18 months, and it was about the amount of titanium oxide, the white pigment used in tattoos, that was showing up in lymph nodes in, sort of downstream, if you will, from tattoos. Tattoos are generally considered safe. They've become extremely normalized. The frequency of tattoos, depending on what geographical location you are on the planet, is anywhere from 12 to 32%. And tattoos have been around for a very, very long time, going back to the late Neolithic period. The thing that's changed in the last 3 decades, I would say, is the nature of the inks that are used. The variety and the vividness of those inks comes at a price. We're going to delve down into that just a little bit in the rest of this program. Because It turns out that while the old materials that were used for tattoos, which were largely carbon and minerals, were pretty inert. They're compounds that were chosen because they didn't migrate that much, and they would sort of stay put at least for decades. But the pigments currently in use get those bright, vivid colors. They were originally developed for industrial applications like car paint, plastics, printer toner, rather than for injection into human skin. Some inks contain it's just a little bit of pigment. You know, you don't really want to worry about those low doses. Some inks contain trace amounts of heavy metals. This would include also the old tattoo inks, but you'll find nickel, chromium, cobalt, occasionally lead. But you'll find organic compounds, and these things are things like azo dyes and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And these are unintentionally introduced. Sometimes they're along for the ride, or they're produced in the skin by actual biochemical processes at the skin level. For example, cytochrome P450 enzymes present in normal skin will break down the ink and change it into a circular compound, which is actually known to be carcinogenic. Benzopyrene is found in carbon black ink. It's considered to be highly carcinogenic by environmental protection agencies when you ingest it, that is to say you breathe it in or you eat it. But the idea that it won't harm you in the skin because it's going to stay put is turning out not to actually be true. The azo dyes are red and orange. They're widely used in textiles and plastics. And this is one that just really creeped me out. When you do laser tattoo removal and break them down, they can break down into aromatic amines that are linked to cancer and genetic damage. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PIHs, that's what you're going to find in the black inks. The colored inks, the yellows and reds I just mentioned, are frequently associated to those azo pigments that can degrade into toxic aromatic amines. And studies show that these pigment particles migrate through the lymphatic system. They accumulate in lymph nodes, but they also get incorporated into macrophages, the large amoebic-like cells. In fact, that happens early on in a tattoo. And the small bits of dye are eaten up by the macrophage, which looks good. They clean it up and drop it into the lymph system, and eventually it leaves the body, except sometimes it doesn't. And instead, it rattles around in the stomach of that macrophage, or its vacuoles, as they're called. And then when that macrophage dies, those vacuoles are eaten by a second macrophage. So they persist and wander around the immune system. And recent data suggests that they actually have an effect on the immune system, causing prolonged inflammation. So my take home on this is if you've got tattoos, you've got tattoos. Leave them alone. Stay away from the lasers. Wear sunscreen because sunlight can actually break down some of the compounds. And do good lymphatic hygiene, which means getting massages and drinking lots of fluid and maybe doing the occasional sweat, and you'll probably be fine. But maybe think twice before getting an entire sleeve when what you've got right now is a bracelet. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.